Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice-weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic. I am Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. We are presented by BetMGM, and we do not yet have a Red Wings end-of-season press conference to dive into today. We delay the show by a day. They delay the press conference by indefinitely longer. So we're just going to go with it. Apologies if the press conference happens in between when you listen to the show and when we're recording it. It won't be too long before we record again, so we'll get to it then. But do you read into anything with this, Prashant, when it comes to the fate of Jeff Blashill, the fact that there has been no announcement yet?
I mean, if you kind of contrast their situation with Columbus, Columbus and Tortorella made an announcement 12 hours after the end of their hockey game that he was not going to be back. Really, actually, that news leaked right after the game with Aaron Portsline, part of the Athletic Columbus, announcing effectively that Tortorella was not coming back. So the more that this sort of drags on, the more that I sort of am biased to believing that this is part of negotiating a contract extension. I don't really have another reason why there would be delays in, this press conference. All the relevant player injuries have been noted on and have already been announced and kind of disposition for them. So really, it only sits down to what is the situation with Jeff Blashill. And I have to imagine it's just hashing out terms of an extension.
You would expect that if they were going to move on, you wouldn't need 3 days to make that call, 3 days plus to make that call. I mean, you have to imagine Yzerman's been deciding what he wants to do for the whole season. If they were going to move on, you would expect it to be swift. The Tortorella situation, I do think, is a uniquely obvious, like, I don't think anybody wanted one more day there with that. But even like, in the NFL, it's they call it Black Monday, 2 days after, 1 day after the season ends, because it's just you cut ties and you get a move on. Now, I guess the counter argument is uncertainty with David Quinn, but I think that's a much different situation with a GM who's been the GM for about 4 days as opposed to this one. So, I don't know. I don't want to, jump the gun at all here, but it would surprise me if they wait 3 days only to move on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of where I'm at. Like, it just doesn't make sense that you would need that anything that would happen in these days would be changing the opinion that Yzerman should already have or already holds in terms of what he wants to do. To me, really, the only reason for delay has to be that they're hashing out, terms here and not dragging this out later and later.
Yeah. So nonetheless, we will get to that whenever they do it, whenever they have that press conference, the end of year presser, whether there is a Jeff Blashill extension or not. But as of right now, there's really not a whole lot more to talk about there until there is. So we will get into what has been the dominant story in the NHL today and yesterday, because the Sabres have been having their end of year press availabilities and there have been some fireworks coming out of Buffalo.
Yeah, I mean, it seems their star player, Jack Eichel, is not all too happy with kind of how he was managed throughout the course of the season. Had this neck injury. I think it was a herniated disc in his neck is the official injury. And he was, I think he was point blank asked, well, why didn't you just get surgery on it? And I think he sort of curtly replies that, well, it's sort of out of my control in terms of what I'm necessarily allowed to do by the team. And sort of talks about, goes on to really say that he's kind of frustrated with how his situation was handled by Buffalo, and that he very ambiguously kind of stated that, well, we don't know if I'm going to be back next season and kind of what my future holds. And so naturally that has fired up the Jack Eichel trade machine. And so every person is kind of running with their mock trades at this time.
I think we might have to join them, at least in a watered down scale. We don't have to do a full mock trade, but I was asked for The Athletic yesterday to say whether the Red, categorize the Red Wings in the Jack Eichel sweepstakes. And I decided, I was kind of waffling between a couple of different options. The four categories we had were front runners. I don't think they're that. We'll test the market. Don't have the assets or cap space. We're not an option. I was waffling between options two and four. We'll test the market and not an option because they absolutely have the cap space and assets. I would by no means consider them a front runner. That leaves two. I actually ended up putting them in the "we'll test the market" category solely because I don't want to rule out Steve Yzerman making a play for one of the very few pieces that they need, one of the hardest pieces to find, who fits their exact age range. I don't know that there's a trade fit here, honestly, between the two teams, and we'll get into that. I don't think anything like this would be likely, but that is how I classified them because I do think the Red Wings have to call here, right?
I think you have to, right? You sort of have to do your due diligence because, I mean, if we're talking about Buffalo's willing to part with Jack Eichel for a first-round pick and a third-round pick, then yeah, you absolutely have to make the phone call there to sort of kick the tires. But, you know, I'd sort of land in the not an option bucket for a couple of reasons. I think if you're Steve Yzerman and you've kind of carefully torn down and allowed these kind of bigger contracts to expire, you've kind of very carefully brought in this younger roster, bringing in a stud piece like Eichel by himself, I think you have to make sure you've got another framework set up to add another piece because I don't think Eichel changes the trajectory by himself. And then you also have to sort of think about what Buffalo is going to command in return. You know, if Buffalo is interested in roster players, you know, is that, you know, if you're looking at the Red Wings, really the only pieces that kind of fit what Buffalo would be interested in is like Dylan Larkin, Philip Zadina, and Moritz Seider, potentially a Lucas Raymond, although I don't know that he's kind of the centerpiece of a deal like that. And so if you're giving up those kinds of roster pieces to land a player like Eichel, how much does he really, you know, move the needle for you? So in my opinion, I don't necessarily see the Wings as a great suitor here unless this can be done entirely with draft picks and the Red Wings are willing to part with that. They obviously have some extra picks, but I think if you start carving up this roster to make a move for Eichel, you don't necessarily end up where I think you want to be, maybe contrasting a scenario where, like, if you were to offer sheet a guy like Pettersson, that's four picks and they're future picks for three of them. You're not necessarily tearing down what's in place and you're actually building off of that.
Yeah, I think ultimately we agree a lot more than we disagree here. I was really struggling on which categorization to put that in. But I just think that the fact that I would say if you're Steve Yzerman, you got a call led me to we'll test the market. I mean, that's kind of what that means. I don't see him as being players on the level of like the Kings, the Ducks, the Wild are all teams who have been mentioned in the last couple days. The Rangers, obviously, that's the front runners for sure. So I agree with you. I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense, partly because I think that the Sabres would be well within their rights to ask for a package that includes not just Moritz Seider, not just a current NHL player in the top half of the Red Wings lineup, but also their 2021 first round pick. You think might even be more than that. And if that's the case, like I wouldn't even do that deal. I wouldn't do Seider, Bertuzzi, and the 2021st for Jack Eichel. I would, if I'm Steve Yzerman, I would not do that. But to your contention, it's possible Buffalo wouldn't either.
Yeah, I mean, if you're Buffalo, you're sitting on a 24-year-old first line center who, when healthy, is comfortably amongst the top 10 forwards in the league, arguably comfortably top 10 forwards in the league.
Ooh, I don't know. I might disagree with that. Okay.
Comfortably top 10 forwards in the league. That's where I'm at here on Jack Eichel. I mean, when he is healthy, he is comfortably a top 10 forward in this league.
So you think like 6 or 7?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can even make an argument for top 5 with Jack Eichel when he's healthy. Yeah, I mean, obviously you're going to take McDavid.
Matthews.
You're going to take Matthews. You know, I think then I'd probably have Mark Stone and Nathan MacKinnon in that bucket. And then after that at 5, I think you're talking about guys like Barkov. You're talking about guys like Eichel. You're talking about some of those other kind of upper echelon forwards. Pettersson's in that category,
Crosby,
as well.
Crosby
at this point is still there. Dreisaitl's still there. I don't think Ovechkin's in that bucket anymore for me. I think he's a little kind of geared one-dimensionally at this point. Braden Point's in that conversation. But yep. Eichel is in that tier of player to me for those guys that are in that kind of realm. Really, the only four guys I'm comfortably saying I'm going to take ahead of Jack Eichel is, you know, exactly who you listed out with McDavid, MacKinnon, Matthews, and Mark Stone. And after that, like, there is a tier of players between, you know, 5 to 10 players where Eichel is very comfortably, you know, towards the top of that crop. And so for me, he's a top 10 forward in the league, and he's 24, and he's got, you know, a lot of people balk at the $10 million contract, particularly with the flat cap. But if that cap starts to escalate with the new TV deals in 2 years, as opposed to, you know, 3 or 4, then that deal ends up not being as bad from a cap hit percentage. And you potentially have a first line center that's a top 10 forward in the league on a reasonable contract.
My pitch for Barkov as cementedly, clearly, establishedly better than Eichel is, Jack Eichel had a career year last year, 1.15 points per game. Alexander Barkov is topping that this year and is going to win the Selke. And oh, by the way, it's not even his highest scoring season of his career.
Yeah, I mean, Barkov's a heck of a hockey player. And that's where I think you can certainly have the conversation that he and Eichel, for me at least, I think they're in the same tier. But I wouldn't dispute anyone who wants to argue that, you know, Barkov's ahead of Eichel. I think if you go a step further and you look at it from like an expected goals above replacement perspective, Barkov has more seasons that are higher than Eichel, but Eichel's peak season is the exact same as Barkov's peak season. Okay. And Eichel's peak season was last year. And so, and he put up 22 expected goals above replacement in 68 games.
And it's worst team context.
Yeah, worst team context, whereas Barkov did 22 expected goals above replacement in 82 games. So
yep.
On a per minute basis, you know, Eichel was a little bit better there. So I think his peak is certainly that of a top 10 forward, if not top 5 forward when he's healthy. That season was just last season. Obviously, this year he had all of the struggles with the neck injuries and challenges like that. But I mean, doing it on an inferior Buffalo team is very impressive in my books. And so if you're able to trade for that and have him be 25, I think if you're Buffalo, you have a really steep asking price here.
Yeah. I mean, I push uncomfortably, but I would have him right around 10. I just would debate between probably like anywhere from like 8 to 11 kind of thing for me. But nevertheless, like, especially as a center, if you add Jack Eichel to your team, there are, and you don't take anyone off your team, if you're the Red Wings, you immediately are a playoff team in my mind. And I think if you're going to make that trade, you can completely justify it on his age, you can justify it on his impact, and you justify it by what did we talk about a month ago? You know, if Dylan Larkin is somewhere between the 25th and 30th best center in the NHL, that means you're going to need a top 10 center to win a Stanley Cup, right? Jack Eichel is that. I think he is definitely a top 10 center in the NHL. So you can justify that. I mean, that gives you, you know, one of the most important boxes to check as a Cup contender. The question is of cost. And so his contract is obviously expensive. That's what it costs to get an elite player. I'm not sweating the $10 million. I maybe the slightest of hesitance with the neck injury. But if you have to give up one of your top two prospects, and I really do think that if it's one of them, the ask would be a Seider. I don't think you can trade a guy like Eichel for a winger. And especially, you know, Moritz Seider has just proven more since his draft year. He's, you know, I think he's the number one prospect on Craig Button's list. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't remember the last time I saw Button's list, but if he's not one, he's, I think, two or three. He's definitely up there. I think him and Raymond
I think
were
they're
top
both.
Three.
Yeah, I think Seider's one, Raymond's three. So it's not obviously not a huge gap either way. Right. But if I'm Buffalo, I'm asking for the guy with the potential to be, you know, a 25-minute a night defenseman. I'm asking for a top line forward, whether that's Bertuzzi or Verana, maybe Zadina. And I'm asking for that top 10 pick. And I just think if you're the Red Wings, yes, all of a sudden you have Eichel. But are you that much closer? Because now you have basically a whole defense corps still to assemble. I mean, you're going to have Hronek and probably, you know, potentially Johansson. But you're not going to have a complete kind of top six or, you know, top two lines of wingers. And you're going to be missing basically an entire top pair defenseman. And you don't really have anywhere to find it without your pick. I mean, maybe you can get it in 2022, but we know defensemen take a while. All of a sudden you've got Eichel, you're spinning your wheels. He gets just as happy in Detroit as he is right now in Buffalo, unhappy, I should say. And how do you know he's not doing the same thing 2 years from now? So I just don't think there's a fit on timeline here if, you know, given what he's going to cost. But if you called Buffalo and they just wanted futures or, you know, they wanted, I can't even imagine what they would want that isn't, one of those two options, like, you know, basically what it would cost to offer Sheedon, which is like your next four first round picks, including this year's. I think you could justify something like that, but I don't think that's what it's going to be. And the pressure to win in Buffalo sooner than later is going to start to get immense. You can't keep churning through generation after generation of top picks who, you know, it doesn't go anywhere with. So that's a long, rambly way of saying I probably should have put him in the not an option category. And maybe that's what I've realized through these first 10 minutes of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, my kind of opinion on it is the only way a Jack Eichel deal makes sense for Detroit is if it's the last deal made as a part of a monumental offseason.
Yeah.
I'm talking, you're going out, you're signing Dougie Hamilton. You're going out, you're bringing in Jamie Oleksiak for defense depth. You're going out, you're bringing in some other winger to play on that. You know, because the Wings do have $50 million in cap space. You're literally making all of these deals. And then the last piece is you're trading for Jack Eichel.
And you're all in on next year at that
point. And you are all in. Like, that is the only way that a move like that makes sense. So, to me, three other dominoes have to fall before you can really get to that point. And you need everything to work out perfectly. Because otherwise, if you just bring in Jack Eichel, to me, it's exactly like you said. You're not taking this team far enough. But if you, again, go out, you get a Dougie Hamilton, you go out, you get a, you know, Jamie Oleksiak, you go out, you find a way to bring in Ryan Nugent Hopkins, you know, maybe even you bring in Brandon Saad on a cheap deal. I'm just literally throwing names out there of what you would have to do to make that make sense with the guys you're going to ultimately have to give up. And then you're really shifting your timeline to, I need to win right now. And if that's the case, that also, that means you have to have the supporting cast in place to win right now. And that's a hockey team that can win, and the Red Wings can mathematically do it because of how much cap space they have. But that really is a huge, huge risk and gamble because, like you said earlier, if Eichel ends up in a scenario where he's unhappy, the added challenge the Red Wings will face is his no-move clause kicks in. And then at that point, you almost end up in a Taylor Hall type situation. Well,
and then it hasn't worked in two places. Right. His reputation starts to be, oh, he's a guy you can't win with, yada, yada. You know how that goes.
I mean, he's already been labeled as the coach killer in a certain sense by people jokingly for the number of coaches that Buffalo's churned through.
And which is an ownership and front office issue more than anything.
That's not fair to Jack Eichel whatsoever. But you're absolutely right. Now you're dealing with a depreciating asset that has a no-move clause attached. As a team, you're not going to be able to get much or nearly as much as you paid for to bring Jack Eichel there. So really, truly, the only way it makes sense is if he's the last piece of the puzzle here, not the centerpiece of your offseason.
I think that's fair. I don't realistically see it. I kind of regret not putting it in the not an option category. But I just felt like if Jack Eichel comes available, you're not doing your job if you don't at least call and just see what it's going to be, you know?
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. You have to call, right? If you don't call and then it ends up being a lot cheaper than you thought, then you're going to sort of kick yourself. It's exactly like what happened with the Anthony Mantha deal, where there were some GMs that came out and said, boy, I wish Steve made us aware that Anthony Mantha was available because I would have made a phone call. It's that kind of deal. You have to make the phone call.
So, you have to make it, and especially because the worst I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of really bad feelings at GM. I have to imagine one of the worst possible ones is seeing a guy get traded for less than you would have happily paid for him, and now you don't have him on your team, and one of your rivals just added him.
Yeah, I mean, there's no worse situation than seeing, you know, like I bet none of those teams in Boston's division were real happy to see Taylor Hall go for Anders Bjork and
a second.
Like, right? Like, no one was happy to see, oh my God, Taylor Hall's in my division now. And that's all that Boston had to pay for it.
Right. So. Probably least of all the Islanders who passed on him to take Palmieri for more than that.
It's Palmieri and Zajac.
Right. So they paid more to get those guys than Hall. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Just a funny move overall. And you know, we'll see. I mean, so you have to make that phone call, I think, at the end of the day. But I think unless Steve Yzerman has several magic tricks planned, this one doesn't make a lot of sense for the Red Wings.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, so you and I got into a back and forth in our text conversation today over what an Eichel trade should cost. Not to the Red Wings specifically, but just at large and the situation that Buffalo is in here. I want to preface it by saying I really think Buffalo is in a tough spot here. I think they're, you know, I think the franchise catches a lot of heat. And I think especially with stuff like this medical surgery thing that's only going to amplify, you know, I have to, you know, I think I love the city of Buffalo. That's what I know it might be sound like a weird thing to say. I think those fans deserve winning hockey so badly. And I think that franchise deserves winning hockey so badly. They have been through the ringer for basically, I mean, certainly my entire time covering this sport, and even, you know, years preceding it. And I don't know if there's a team in the NHL that I would be like happier for them to see them turn the corner and succeed, because it's just, you know, it's the city that you see at the very top of the NHL ratings almost every year, despite the fact that they're never in the cup. That is a hockey city. They have some amazing talent. I kind of can't believe it hasn't come together for them yet. I want to see this happen for Buffalo, and I want to see it happen for them with Jack Eichel in their uniform. That said, I think they're in a really hard spot, and I almost think they kind of are going to have to trade him, even if it means losing the trade. And I don't see a way they ultimately win the Jack Eichel trade. And you kind of think that they have some room to hold out more. So I wanted to have that dialogue a little bit back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, I think the crux of what I kind of believe Buffalo can do here is obviously not the most likely scenario for Buffalo based on their track record here, but I think to start, I sort of consider Jack Eichel to be a top 10 forward in the NHL. I'll restate that here. And that's sort of what drives my perspective here. So when you have a 24-year-old forward, presumably going to be 100% healthy for the start of next season, right in the middle of their prime, locked into a deal for, you know, several more years, Eichel's under contract through 2025, 2026. My kind of opinion would be you need to do everything you can to hang on to elite talent, right? We've talked about this episode after episode after episode that the most important part of a rebuild is acquiring elite talent. And Buffalo has it. They have an elite talent in Jack Eichel, and they have that elite talent in his prime. And they have it locked up. They're not going to be paying money there. So my number one mission, if I was the Pegulas, the owners of Buffalo, would be I need to repair my relationship with Jack Eichel, and I don't know, and I need to do what it takes. And that's not to say that he gets unilateral decision-making of who his coach is and who his GM is and things like that, but you need to have that open dialogue that we often see happen in the NBA, in the NFL, other sports that find a way to center priorities around their franchise players such that they can build good teams around them. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But to me, if you are destined to lose a trade for Jack Eichel that resets your rebuild, you're going to get, you know, pennies on the dollar, then your number one priority should be, before I get forced into that, is there anything I can do from a relationship-saving standpoint to preserve my ability to hang on to this elite talent who's in his prime and under contract?
My thing is, do you actually have the luxury to take that time and that swing? Because if you aren't able to, I agree with you. Like you try whatever you can, but I'm just skeptical that if you take that year, what's the odds that you can actually convince him? And what I really think is, and other people have pointed this out, it's been reported Jack Eichel's no move kicks in next year. Like you said, if you wait a year and it's still not fixed a year from now, and you're going to have to trade him then, all of a sudden you've lost a ton of the market because Jack Eichel can call his shot at that point for where he wants to go. Now, you could probably go to him and say, look, if you want out so bad, give us somewhere to send you. But, you know, at the end of the day, once that kicks in, the player has a lot more control. The team has a lot less leverage. And I think the bet you're making isn't, you know, okay, is it at all feasible to make Jack Eichel happy again. I'm sure it probably could be, but you're going to have to do it in 1 year, and I don't think this team is a playoff team next year. And if the crux of it does come down to winning beyond just the medical staff stuff, then all of a sudden you have to win in a year when you probably can't win. I mean, they went out last year and they got Taylor Hall, didn't win, didn't go anywhere. Like, they got him an MVP wingman. It didn't work. And now they're here, right? So, you know, obviously the switch to Don Granato late in the season seemed to go well for the Sabres. Maybe if Eichel could play for him, maybe that makes him a little happier. I don't know. But they've cycled through coaches and GMs enough. They've made enough changes there. I think what that franchise probably needs more than anything is stability. And ideally, Jack Eichel staying would be part of that stability. But I don't know that you can be as drastic as you would probably need to be to, like, show, like, look, we're changing everything for you. And then expect to see results in the next year before that no move clause kicks in. So I think there's a timer element to it, and there's a scope element of it. Like, how much of the organization can you, should you turn over for Jack Eichel? To me, I think more than anything in the world, what that organization needs is stability.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely echo that they need stability. And I think part of the reason why they are where they are is when you continue to disrupt philosophies and management styles by constantly firing your GM and constantly firing your coach,
rearranging the whole scouting staff. It's
right. What you end up doing is you continue to change the plan such that you never have a coherent plan. So, you know, the approach with Eichel isn't, I don't necessarily view it as a this year or next year kind of deal, because fundamentally we should all be very honest. There is nothing Buffalo could do right now that could make this team a winning hockey team next season. I think we can agree on that. There's fundamentally nothing they can do. So that shouldn't be the benchmark. That shouldn't be the benchmark on what you're going to do.
But is it his benchmark? But is it his benchmark, right? Like if in a year he still wants out and now the no move clause kicked in because you didn't win, now what do you do?
So if that's the case, right, then that means there, from my management standpoint, I can't repair that relationship. If that's what it is for Jack Eichel, he needs to win next season, I can't do anything about that, and I have to make the deal. Right. But for me, my idea or philosophy behind it would be, look, Jack, you're 24 years old. You know, let me lay out this plan of how I'm going to bring this team back. This is the management style we're going to have. This is what we're going to do. These are kind of the things that I'd like us to move, you know, season after season after season. These are the people I'm bringing in to make that happen. Here's their track record. I also want you to have some input and dialogue on this. You know, effectively open up that path of communication. And if Eichel's willing to sign on to that, then that's great. And I've taken that step forward to repair that relationship. And at that point, I'm in for the long haul. I know I'm going to lose any deal if I go in the no move clause, but I'm also going to lose any deal right now. I just may lose it by less. But if I at least can lay out that plan, get him to buy in and make him feel like he is the franchise player, because he is that franchise player, and then start bringing in the people to figure out, what do we need to do to make this team better? You got to get rid of the Jeff Skinner contract. That is a horrible, horrible contract that is going to impact this hockey team for years to come. You have to find a way to keep Sam Reinhart. That needs to be a priority for Jack Eichel. He's been a heck of a hockey player for them. You got to try and get out of the Kyle Okposo contract as well. You got to figure out what you're doing on defense. There's a lot of things Buffalo has to do. But to me, again, I don't know the intimacies of the situation. I don't know what's already been said. All of this could have already happened, making my point moot. But at the end of the day, if I can lay out a coherent roster turnover plan, a coherent vision for this team, and when I think I can compete, my hope is that I can get Eichel to buy in and go from there. But if I can't, then at that point, I need to follow exactly what you're saying and get the most that I can out of him. And you could be right. All of this could already happen, and this is beyond reparations here, or beyond repair. But at the, I guess, to me, knowing Buffalo and how much they've turned things over, I don't know that this has happened. And that's where I would at least want to start.
I see. So I would think I was misunderstanding you earlier, because I thought what you were kind of advocating for was, you know, clean house again and that. But I think I'm hearing you differently. Like, you're not saying do any more turnover here. You're just saying maybe bring him in more, give him a little more, you know, clarity into the vision, and try to kind of sell him more than like, hey, we'll give you whoever coach you want, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying like turn this into a LeBron James running Cleveland okay. situation where he is picking his coach. He's picking, you know, the like GM. He's bringing in Tyronn Lue to be his coach, and he's picking certain players to come play with him. The problem is in the NBA, you can build around LeBron James. LeBron James can take a team of nobodies to the NBA Finals. He did in 2007.
Yeah.
The value and impact of a superstar in the NHL is simply less because they don't play as much.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of the day, what hasn't been communicated to Eichel, and I could be wrong here, is a coherent vision on how Buffalo gets better, how he fits into that, and how he should have a dialogue in that. I'm not saying that he gets to come in and pick his GM. I'm not saying he comes in to pick his coach, but he needs to be included in the decision-making. At the end of the day, he needs to have a voice at the table as your franchise player, as a top 10 forward in the NHL, in my opinion. I think that needs to happen for Buffalo with Eichel. And I don't know that that's happened yet. If it has, then yeah, I agree. This is beyond repair. You gotta kind of cut your losses and get the most you can for Eichel here. But these teams tend to lose these deals anytime you're moving these guys, unless they're forcing their way in a Lindros fashion to a specific team. More often than not, you lose these deals. And so if you're Buffalo, you should be trying to do everything you can to prevent yourself from losing that deal, which to me comes down to laying out a coherent vision for how this team gets better.
I think I agree with you on more of that than I realize. But what I will say is I just think you can't be afraid to lose the trade if it makes you win on the ice eventually. Like I think you should be prepared to lose the Eichel trade in that the pieces you get probably don't add up to Jack Eichel's, let's say you get three pieces, they're probably not going to give you 22 goals above replacement in one season. Like it's probably not going to happen like that. But you know, Jack Eichel's a $10 million player, so if you can win it and you know open yourself up some flexibility to do some other things, and you get young players on cheap contracts who eventually grow up into really solid contributors. If you can get top pair, top line players, multiple of them, I do think eventually you can build a winner that way on volume, and you just have to do it a little different way rather than being the team that's driven by, the two superstars and Eichel and Dahlin, although it sounds like maybe Reinhart could go too, who knows, like maybe you're driven by Dahlin and a bunch of, really, really good Dylan Cousins types, two top prospects that you get back in this trade and a first round pick. You're going to get potentially, certainly a top three pick this year to add into that. So whether that be an Owen Power, a Matt Beniers, a Brant Clark, a Luke Hughes, whatever that may be, right? Like, I think you can win with volume if you make the right trade. You still might lose the trade in the eyes of some, but if you become a winning team on the other side of it, it's okay. I think you can't be so afraid to lose the trade that you lose the plot, I guess is how I would put it.
So let me throw this then, right? So you make the deal for Jack Eichel. You decide that you're going to trade him.
Yeah.
Once Buffalo trades Jack Eichel, how far off are they from being the 2019-2020 Red Wings?
Probably not that far.
Right. They're probably the 2019-2020 Red Wings, who we now sit and talk about a five-year timeline for them last year. Yep. So that's what you're doing to Buffalo, is you're now saying, I need to start from scratch. Except the problem for Buffalo is, unlike the 1920 Red Wings, which were setting themselves up for a lot of cap flexibility, they still have two more years of Kyle Okposo. They still have several more years of Jeff Skinner at $9 million. They still are in salary cap hell with those deals. If you're really committing to that, you got to find a way to move those deals as well as the Eichel deal. But you're basically resetting yourself back to 1920 Detroit. And if you are Buffalo, how many times are you going to do this, right? You're now going back to where you were in 2014, 2015, when this was a team tanking for McDavid. Now, to be fair, tanking for Shane Wright next season or Connor Bedard and, Michkov the season after that, that's not a bad way to be, given how skilled those guys are. We just saw it at the U18s. But you are now putting yourself in that position where, again, you need to find elite talent. And that's to me, we go back a couple episodes, right? You said you would take Buffalo's rebuild over anyone because they had the elite talent. And now you're going to scrap it and go right back to where Detroit was.
If the elite talent's going to leave, demanding out, like it's a different story. Like I think I even said on that day, I'm assuming that they keep Jack Eichel. Like if that, all bets are off if that can't happen. But you're exactly right. I mean, the thrust of your point is you're as close as you've been, even if it doesn't seem like it, in terms of the talent acquisition phase. Now you just got to get these guys happy. So
yeah, I mean, you have the pieces here if you are Buffalo to become a better hockey team.
Yes,
Dylan Cousins is a heck of a hockey player. Sam Reinhart is great. And then obviously you have Jack Eichel. While Dahlin hasn't necessarily been what people thought he would be, he still has that, potential, in my opinion, to be a better hockey player. You're going to add a top three pick this year, and you're likely adding a top five pick next year. You still have Jack Quinn in the system. To me, there are pieces here to build a hockey team around. And if you come to Eichel and say, all right, I'm going to get someone to take this Jeff Skinner deal. I'm going to get out of this Kyle Okposo deal. I'm going to make sure Reinhart gets paid. I'm going to make sure that we sort out what we're doing on defense, and we're going to make good picks at the 21 and 22 draft. This is a hockey team that can be competitive, exactly like you said in that episode. So that's where I think you have to do everything you possibly can to exhaust keeping Jack Eichel before you decide that you're going to lose that deal, because you are going to lose that deal.
Yeah. I think you've won me over to a much higher degree than I expected coming onto this show. So it will be the story of the summer. I can assure you of that. And I really hope that whatever it happens, I really hope that it works out for Buffalo. Like that, that organization, that team, they deserve some joy, some wins, some celebration here. I really hope it goes well for them.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it works out for Buffalo. I hope it works out for Jack Eichel. He's become,
for sure.
I think the frustrating part from Eichel's standpoint is he doesn't get talked about in the same circles, because it was the McDavid and Eichel draft, and
so
Connor McDavid. And then very quickly after, Austin Matthews is right behind him and almost erases sort of Jack Eichel in that sense. And because of the injury this year being stuck in Buffalo, we just don't talk about how good of a hockey player Jack Eichel is. He's a phenomenal hockey player. And so whatever happens, I hope he gets on a team that has a vision, whether it's in Buffalo or somewhere else, and that Buffalo, that fan base, really deserves something better than what they've had. I'll say that.
And I think the franchise does too, like the org. Like, I know people are mad at the Pagulas.
But the Pagulas suck. I'm going to say that.
That's fine. But like the people who work in that organization, think about the sweat that goes into a season, in scouting and trying to put all this stuff the together. People, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yep. The people of the franchise deserve better.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. So, all right, moving on. We got some unbelievable mailbag questions today. We're going to get to as many of them as possible. I think we got about 20 minutes here, 20, 25 minutes or so.
Let's do it.
All right. Here's one that I thought was interesting from Lars. Ties back to a conversation that you and I were having a couple of days ago. Is Rasmussen the Glendening of the future? Do we want to go into our bizarro explanation that we gave then, or do we just want to answer this one straight up?
I mean, I probably was just better served answering it straight up, in that he's better than Luke Glendening. Let me just say that. But I think on a really competitive hockey team, you probably want him slotting on that third or fourth line center. So he ultimately fills the role, but he's a better hockey player.
All right, I'm going to give my take and just see what happens. So I think Michael Rasmussen is an extraordinarily difficult player to conceptualize what he looks like on a cup contender, because when you say it, you almost have to double take, right? Like he is a, in my opinion, a 15 minute per night fourth line center. Now, that doesn't mean I don't think he's a third line center caliber player on like a bunch of teams in the NHL, even playoff teams. But I think if you're talking about not a contender, your ideal role for Michael Rasmussen is as a matchup center. That's often the kind of role that Glendening does play. But then he's also probably on power play one. And if he projects to what you want him to be, penalty kill one. So that adds up to playing a role that is more reminiscent of like a middle six, borderline top six player if you get up north of 15 minutes per night. And I think that's what you will want of Rasmussen. So I think at evens, you're going to want to play him on a hard to play against line. You're going to want to play him, I think a line that has more offense than the classic Glendening Ernie Helm line has. But if you told me that like the Red Wings, kind of matchup line of the future included let's say it's Michael Rasmussen, Robert Master Simone, and Adam Ernie or something like that. That's a line that can score, but that's a line that also gives you some hard to play against. You know what I mean? Or even if you wanted to throw Elmer Soderblom or something on there, right? Like at some point, I do think you want that to be a matchup line. And right now the Red Wings are kind of having to play matchup lines on the third and fourth line. But as a contender, you'd probably really only want to have to do it on the fourth, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like the role you're sort of describing is almost like what Darren McCarty did for the Red Wings for a really long time.
Yeah.
Particularly in the early 90s. I mean, in the early 90s, he would occasionally play on the top line as a forward, but as kind of the 90s rolled on, he sort of shifted into that third or fourth line winger role, but he would play on the first power play occasionally, and he would play on the first penalty kill occasionally. And so it was like he was a guy that ended up averaging about, you know, anywhere from, I think, as many as 17 minutes a night to some other seasons, it was 13 minutes a night or 11 minutes a night. But he was a guy that could, you know, sort of do all of those things. So I think Michael Rasmussen has some of that skill, but is probably best suited lower in the lineup, like you're saying.
Yeah, I think he's a bottom six player who's going to be on your first unit of both special teams. I just think that's a tough thing for people to conceptualize, but that's how I see him, at least. I might be wrong. That's just how I see him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he certainly demonstrated that he has that he's proficient in some of the skills that you would like to be there. And so I don't see why that's not a reasonable thing to think about him. Kind of a guy to equate him to is maybe a McCarty type. So
yeah. Now the grind line, classically, help me out here. They were kind of a third line, right?
Yeah, I mean, they were the third line. There was the checking line. I think as their careers went on, some of them started to fall into the fourth line. But yeah, I mean, that was primarily a third checking line.
So that's kind of your dream scenario, right? Is a third line that includes like a Rasmussen and a Veleno and somebody else, right?
Yeah, because I mean, at that point, you're almost effectively recreating, you know, that grind line, because I think a lot of people sort of forget that like Kirk Muhlty scored 50 in juniors. Like that was a guy playing on your third line as a checker, was that sort of, you know, offensive talent. I mean, McCarty was also a heck of a hockey player in juniors. So it's like, yeah, if you're able to make that your third line, where it's like Joe Veleno, who is an exceptional status player, and, you know, Michael Rasmussen, who is, you know, a top 10 pick, if that ends up being your third line, then you're in a really good spot.
Yeah. All right. That's good. On to the next one. And that was from Lars. I don't know if I said that, by the way, but this next one is from Phil. He says, if the Red Wings don't re-sign Bernier, what are the other goalie options? I would lead with Chris Driedger, although I'm sure he's going to be an in-demand name after what he did this year, but Antti Raanta's out there too, right? That'd be another one.
Yeah, I mean, Raanta would be an interesting player for sure. I think, you know, we've sort of talked about Driedger on past episodes. I think my biggest hesitancy with him is just you're going to be competing and that money gets driven up. I think, you know, other names that I've thrown out, James Reimer, Philip Grubauer's out there. Dave Rittich is another name out there if you're prepared to go with kind of Grace as your starter all the way through. You know, so those are a couple of guys that I kind of
like. Brassois in Winnipeg?
I not as a guy. I mean, you not have to be really, not as a 1B. Like, you would need to make sure Grice is prepared to play 70% of those games.
That's fair.
I mean, Brassois could certainly fill in, but I don't know about that. And then, you know, alternatively, you know, you explore some other trade options. Obviously, we talked about the Rangers with Georgiev and Shesterkin there. I mean, that's a possibility.
Franzos.
Yeah, and then Franzos in Colorado if they end up electing to re-sign Grubauer. But ultimately, I think there's a handful of different options out there that could be reasonable ones to pull in.
All right, so that's in net. Handsome Hockey Pod wants to know, you've talked about who some of the Red Wings' own UFAs might get re-signed. What about UFAs out there that might make sense for the Red Wings at this time? I think this is probably a topic that it's like a little premature on. Some of the guys are going to get re-signed, you know, before it even gets there. I think expansion draft maybe complicates it slightly too. But are there any, like, you know, even if we just minimize this to forwards a little bit, is there anyone that you think would be like a good fit for the Red Wings who's hitting the market? I assume, you know, the Landeskogs, the Halls, the Ovechkins, the, you know, David Krejci. Is he a UFA this year?
Is Krejci? Yeah, Krejci's the UFA this year.
Yeah, so like I assume those are kind of out of the range, but is there anyone who does stand out UFA wise among like forwards who jumps out at you? Let's say they have one to fill, because I think that's probably close to accurate.
Yeah, I think they're going to have one to fill. I think a guy that I threw out as being a reasonable option was Mikhail Grigorenko, who's kind of played a little bit of bottom six center slash wing for the Jackets. Not the strongest of centers, but certainly a guy that could fill your bottom six role if you elect to move on from a Glendening or move on from Gagne. You know, I think he's a guy you could bring in to handle a lot of those responsibilities. So he's probably the big one that at least is on my radar. Jordan Martinook's another guy who, if Carolina elects not to bring him back, he's a great energy guy, has some skill, can do a lot of different things for you. So I think he'd be a nice hockey player to bring in. You know, the Alex Galchenyuk redemption tour in Toronto, if he's able to come in and be a cheap offering for you. He's looked reasonably good in Toronto. You bring him in on $1 million. I think that's another option there. So I think there's a handful of guys you could certainly consider. And then obviously Blake Coleman's another one who he'll be an unrestricted free agent. I don't believe Tampa will have the capacity to re-sign him, but no. He's another guy who can be in the third line or fourth line for you and do a lot of damage there.
Philip Deneau, too rich for your blood?
It's tough. I mean, I sort of think he's going to get a contract north of $4 million.
I do too.
And if that's the case, I probably am steering away from competing in a UFA market, but he's a great hockey player too.
Okay. I asked you about forwards there because the next question is from Will S. If you had to bring one UFA defense partner specifically for Seider for his first season in Detroit, who would that be?
Yeah, if you're bringing a UFA in, I really like Jamie Oleksiak. I think he's looked really nice in Dallas. Left shot, big.
Is he UFA?
Mobile. He's a UFA.
I had no idea.
Making a little over $2 million, so I think he could reasonably bring him in. He's 28. Good skater, can move the puck well. I think he'd be a nice option. Pair. Yeah, I mean, now you're looking at, you know, what is Oleksiak, 6'7", 6'8",
yeah.
And then Seider's obviously, you know, 6'5". I mean, that is a gigantic mobile defense pair. That would be a lot of fun to watch. And that's honestly probably my ideal partner. You know, Jordy Benn's another guy who I think could be a reasonable option. He's a UFA this year, left shot, that could play there. Alec Martinez is a veteran defenseman who he's sort of dropped off, but, Stanley Cup experience with the Kings, playing with Vegas right now, might get another cup there. I think he'd be another heck of a hockey player to bring on if you could get him relatively cheap.
Hometown kid, right?
Yeah. Yep. You'd be a lot of fun.
Am I allowed to say John Merrill, or do you think that counts as not a UFA because he was in Detroit most of the season?
I mean, I think that still counts, right? You would still have to re-sign him if he was even here in Detroit, so that still counts.
I said it earlier this year that I thought, before they traded Merrill, that I thought he would be a really good D partner for Moritz Seider, and that hasn't changed. I think it accomplishes two things. Number one, it allows you to play Seider with someone who was, you know, arguably had some of the best defensive impacts of any Red Wings defense, but as did Patrick Nemeth. Both of them were really good. But, you know, had some of the best defensive impacts. That allows Seider to not have to be entirely focused on defense as a rookie. He can take some risks and have a safety valve back there, a veteran who's going to help him out there. At the same time, it does allow you to use that as a shutdown pair and lean into Seider's strength on the defensive end and his physicality and deploy that in really tough matchups and still allow Seider to take those risks. So I think he's kind of a dream partner in that way. I think you'd envision a similar dynamic to your Oleksiak point in that situation. So I don't think that's a bad idea by any means either. I just, when I was thinking of Merrill and Seider earlier this year, I thought this would make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, Merrill's another guy that would be a great defensive partner. You know, another guy who's out there, Jake McCabe with the Sabres.
Yep.
He got injured, I think, early on in the season, but he's looked quietly very good. And so he's another, I think, really solid defensive player. And honestly, the whole reason we're talking about kind of the defensive guy to play with Mo Seider is so that they have a little bit, so that he really has a little bit more freedom to kind of feel out the game and kind of play within his, kind of within his skill set. It's almost like what Nick Lidstrom had when he first came over to North America and played with the Red Wings, played with Brad McCrimmon. And Brad McCrimmon was defensive defenseman, and it allowed Nick Lidstrom to go up and down the ice, pinch in when he wanted to, because he knew Brad always had his back. And so same concept here, where you'd want a guy that can basically be that for Mo Seider, be a safety valve.
Yeah, so I think those are some good options to look at, and you know, I do think Seider's going to succeed next year, not regardless of who they play him with, but in most scenarios that they play, you know, no matter who they play him with. So I think it's going to be okay no matter what. Those are just some guys who I would see as kind of dream fits. So
yeah, for sure.
David Jackson wants to know, how good is Lucas Raymond, and is he justified for being a little nervous about the scoring numbers in the SHL this year?
I think Lucas Raymond's a heck of a hockey player. I think he's very, very talented. I would not be nervous at all about Lucas Raymond's scoring numbers. I think we've said this on previous episodes. The Frölunda team that he plays on is one of the lowest scoring teams in the SHL. So even though they were a kind of good hockey team and they're a good development program, they're also a team that just simply does not score a lot of goals. I think they scored like the fourth or fifth fewest amount of goals in the SHL this year. It's just 133 goals in 52 games. So, you know, there's not a lot of points to really go around. It's almost the same concept as if you looked at the Red Wings roster and said your leading point getter had 26 points in 56 games. Like, that's not great. And I think it's the same issue for Raymond and Frölunda. So I think what you should really be looking for is wherever he ends up next season, likely in Grand Rapids, but potentially even in the NHL, I'd expect him to really be able to display his offensive skills a lot more.
Yeah, and I would caution people, like, when Lucas Raymond does come over, like, don't expect a point per game NHL. Like, that's setting yourself up to be disappointed if you put that expectation on. But, like, you know, expect him to develop into a top six, first line, like, kind of player. But remember what we talked about like a month back, that does not mean point per game. Like those players are not, that's not what you call a first line player. That's an elite player. So I would say, and it's possible he can become that, but I'm just saying, don't set that as the bar. He didn't dominate that. I don't think this year was like a red flag for me, by any means. And I think, you know, when we've talked about his, you know, his shot share, his goals for percentage, like all that stuff is really promising, for the kind of player who's going to be highly, highly impactful. And again, I know people are sick of this, but like, think more overall impact on the game than score sheet, score sheet, score sheet for him, right?
Yeah, I would completely agree. And I mean, if you're looking for a guy to sort of compare against, look at Tim Stützle in Ottawa. I think at the beginning of the year, he sort of really struggled to get off the schneid. I think he was having a little bit more difficulty, even though you could very much see the skill was there. But, you know, basically towards the end of the season, he closes the season with a hat trick the other night. And so I think he's a guy that's kind of slowly but surely found his way. But season didn't look all that impressive, and he didn't score as much as, you know, people would want being a point per game hockey player. And so I think that's sort of what I would expect to see from a Lucas Raymond in his first year in the NHL is, you know, something closer to what Stützle did, which was about half a point per game to 0.6 points per game in that kind of realm.
Chris R. wants us to celebrate the offseason with a tankathon spin. Are you up for it?
All right. Are you spinning or am I spinning?
I will spin. Vancouver is down 1-0 at the end of the first, so that will not change anything, most likely. I mean, I guess they could come back, but we'll say it doesn't. Sim lottery. All right, in this lottery, the Red Wings will pick 8th.
So par for the course where they can drop the maximum number of spots, right?
That's right. So this one would have the San Jose Sharks in the first pick. Who do you like for San Jose?
First overall, I think you're probably picking Owen Power at this point.
How about the LA Kings?
I mean, if the Kings are able to jump up to 2, so I'm assuming they're winning a lottery here.
Yep. That is what it is. Yep.
And so, I mean, the Kings are already so damn loaded, up front with, you know, Vilardi and Turcotte and Byfield. And, so for me, I'm probably leaning defense if I'm the Kings and maybe looking at Brant Clark, but honestly, it's hard to pass up, you know, Beniers or Eklund there. But I think for our purpose, I'm going to go with my strategy and give him the forward. And let's say they take Matty Beniers. So 1-2 for Michigan.
You really think they go another center?
You can always move him out to wing, right?
You're not moving Beniers to the wing. You're moving someone else to the wing. You're moving Turcotte or something.
You move Turcotte to the wing. Yeah. Move Turcotte to the wing.
Or you're trading for Jack Eichel, I guess.
Or you trade for Jack Eichel, right? So.
All right. I'm stunned. I thought for sure you were going defenseman there. So that leaves 3 is Buffalo. Who do you like there?
So if you're Buffalo, you need everything. I think the most skilled player on the board here is probably William Eklund, and that's who I'd probably give Buffalo at 3.
I was thinking Hughes, but all right.
I don't know, man. Ducks. I'm worried about his foot. I'm worried about his foot.
It's totally fair. Totally more fair. Than others. 4 is Anaheim. Who do you got for the Ducks?
So Anaheim's a fun one because they could really go in any direction here. I think they probably go defense, you know, although you could argue they really need everything here. But I think probably Luke Hughes is a go at 4 here.
Seattle at 5. The first player in franchise history is?
Oh, boy. Probably Brant Clark.
Okay. 6, the New Jersey Devils. They got to think defense, right?
I would think they have to think defense, and I think they're probably looking at Simon Edvinson here.
All right. 7, Columbus. They'd really love to be up there in the range to take Matthew Beniers as a refresher right now. What?
I said, oh, they certainly would, because they would love a center more than anything else.
So refresher on the board here at 6, you've got Dylan Genther, you've got Kent Johnson, you've got Chaz Lucius, Fabian Lysell, Mason McTavish, your boy Jesper Wallstedt. Anybody stand out?
I mean, if you're Columbus, you have one of two options. You either take a player who's listed as a center right now, who may not play center at the NHL, or you take a more skilled player in Dylan Genther. And I think if you're Columbus, you probably have to do that. I know, you know, Genther's coach has said they're potentially, you know, giving him a little bit of minutes at center, but I think if you're Columbus, you can't pass the talent. So I think Dylan Genther has to go there.
All right. So then that brings us to the Red Wings, and you've got on the board Kent Johnson, Chaz Lucius, Fabian Lysell, Mason McTavish, Jesper Wallstedt, Carson Lambos and Carson Kuhlmans. Anybody really jumping out to you? I guess you could even look at a Matt Coronato, a Cole Sillinger.
If I'm here, this is sort of like danger zone for me, because the top 7 guys who I think are maybe a notch above everyone else are all gone at this point. So for me, I'm sort of going to reach a little bit further down and look at Mason McTavish, who I thought had a really nice U18s. You know, his game looked a little disengaged at times in Switzerland this year, but I think he's a guy that has all of the skills to potentially even play center. We'll see. He's got some size to him, too, at 6'1", 210. So that's where I would go from Detroit.
I thought I was going to have to talk you into that.
No. You really weren't. I mean, Mason McTavish is, to me, the best player here. And so if I'm Detroit, I'm either trying to trade down to see if I can get him at 11 or 12 if someone wants to jump up, or I'm just gonna go ahead and do it. Take the best player on my board there.
I think I would be between McTavish, Johnson, and I would entertain a trade down as well at this point. But, you know, I would give certainly consideration to Johnson. I think upside-wise, he's your upside play here, right?
Yeah, I mean, him and Fabian Lysell are the two upside plays here. Lysell obviously had some struggles, you know, in the SHL in terms of getting minutes and being able to consistently produce. But he did look occasionally dangerous at times for Sweden in the U18s. So he's an upside play. Obviously, Kent Johnson's insanely skilled. Do worry a little bit about his ability to make those plays at the next level. He is going to play winger also. But you can't deny the talent there. So both of those guys are high upside swings. To me, I think Mason McTavish has the most buckets or most, you know, balls in the upper echelon buckets when comparing kind of Johnson and Lysell and McTavish there. I think
Johnson would have marbles in a higher.
He would he would have more marbles in a higher bucket.
In the very top bucket, right. But marbles in the top half, maybe.
Yeah, that's sort of where I'm at with him is like, I think he has a huge range of outcomes. And while he does have a couple marbles in that top high-end bucket, I am nervous that he's also got a couple marbles in the, you know, third-line, fourth-line player bucket where he's not going to likely be all that successful. So that's the only thing that gives me pause with taking him there versus a McTavish, who I think is maybe a little bit more polished.
McTavish is the guy who, after the World U18s, I wish that I had put on my top 10 draft board. If the Red Wings do fall to 8, I will spend quite a bit more time digging in on him, because I think he will very much need to be in that conversation.
Yeah, I think he's a guy to watch if the Red Wings do end up dropping a couple spots.
They could still drop as low as 9, right? Technically?
As of now, because Vancouver is not past them. So now Detroit owns the 6th best lottery odds, but that is contingent on Vancouver obtaining 5 more points or 5 points plus 2 regulation wins, or 6 or more points in their final, I think, 7 games. Sounds like they're already down 1-0 as we're recording this here. So not looking good. Although they have 4 games to close against Calgary, games that are not being played for anything because Calgary is already eliminated. So maybe something happens. We'll see.
All right. I wasn't going to read this one if the tankathon went out a certain way, but since the Red Wings dropped 2 in it, Moonman Hot Tick says, who would you want with the 6th overall pick? So let's just rewind it by 2. I'll put both Edvinson and Who'd you take? Genther on the board for you at six. Do you take one of those two above McTavish? And which one?
I take Genther above McTavish. I think Genther, supremely talented scoring winger. I do think he has a little bit of an Anthony Mantha vibe to him in the sense that at times, you know, people will say he looks like he disengages a little bit. But in this draft, I think getting a guy with his shot, his skill level, at the sixth overall pick is hard to deny. I mean, he dominated the WHL in their short season this year and really made up for that. He didn't look hugely impressive at the U18s, partly because everyone on Canada was scoring all of the goals. And it was very hard to sort of stand out over Shane Wright and Connor Bedard for that team. But I do think he has the talent. It's just he's got to stay engaged for the course of a hockey game.
And then because you knew this was coming, another follow-up, this one from Chris G. If they pick six or lower, would they take Jesper? Obviously, we can't answer whether they would. We're not going to have the whole litigation debate. But I'm just going to say, I think like that's number one. There probably is a point in this first round where even if they shouldn't, Wallstedt enters the conversation. I do not think it is as high as sixth.
For me, it's about 28. I'm just going to say that's where he sort of enters the conversation. Cause at that point I've made my Washington pick and, then I'm at least using my second pick on that. But, you know, I can't litigate this over and over.
I think it's 15 or 16 for me. I think that's where it would be for me.
It's tough because here's the thing. I think there's other goaltenders in this draft who are going to be really good goaltenders. And, you know, just look at what the Red Wings have done the last few years where they just continue to recycle out top 10 goaltending from free agency for a couple million bucks. Why do I want to spend, you know, high draft capital getting things that I'm just pulling out of free agency left and right? Yep. Like, that's just where I'm at. It has nothing to do with the player. It has nothing to do with how good they are. It has very little to do with how good we think they're going to be. It has everything to do with the position and the number of options available. It's just like, you know, if you went to the store and there was this, you know, I'm gonna turn this into whiskey analogies here.
Right.
You walk into the store and there's a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle 15 years sitting on the shelf. Huge rarity. But, you know, the store, they've marked it up to secondary market pricing, and it's $1,500 for the bottle. You can pay for that, and you're going to have a Pappy Van Winkle bottle. Or, you know, there's a bottle of Blanton sitting on the shelf, and it's sitting there for $50. And that's a really dang good bottle. It's not a Pappy Van Winkle bottle, but it's a really solid bottle, and I only spent $50. I'm going to buy the Blanton's bottle 10 out of 10 times. Nothing against the Pappy Van Winkle bottle. It's a better bottle. It's arguably the best in the world. But I'm not spending that much money on it. I'm going to buy the cheaper bottle that gives me a lot of value from it. And that's where I'm at.
Let me tell you about a goalie really quick. Blind resume, okay?
All right.
Our man is 32 years old. Our man was the 11th overall pick in a draft. And I'm going to give you his save percentages from age 22 to now by year, okay?
All right.
913. 909, 922, 922, 912, 908, 915, 913, 904, 907, 914. Successful 11th overall pick as a goalie?
I mean, the context I would sort of need is how many games did he play in each of those seasons?
Okay, so total games, 387.
Okay. So, I mean,
it's about 38 games a year
at 11th overall. To me, that's not a successful 11th overall pick. I mean, you got an NHL goaltender, sure. But I think the variables that you would need to know is from the time of that draft. So when he was the 11th overall pick, when did he actually play his first game for that team? How many games did he actually play for the team that drafted him?
Okay.
And because like otherwise, if you're evaluating just as an 11th overall pick, that's great. But you should also evaluate it by the team that drafted him and what did they actually get from him.
So that run that I read you started 4 years after he was drafted. I'm not going to tell you how many games he played for the franchise because it's going to give it away. But I just want to know, like where on the outcome of drafting a goalie does that outcome rank for you? Like if you draft a goalie at, let's say 11th overall or 9th overall or whatever it might be, and you get that outcome, where is your emotion level? Let's say they're all for the team that drafts him.
I mean, if they're all for the team that drafts him and his
level, or at least the first play, 7 years, I don't know.
Yeah. Sure. And maybe we say also that his level of play isn't so high such that I've had to pay him an exorbitant amount of money.
Like he makes $3 million.
Right. If I continue to give him $3 million a year and pay for that level of production, I'm very satisfied. But it's going back to what I said, I think, at the opening of the show. You could shut out, I could have a goaltender that shuts out the opponent every single night. And at the end of the day, I have to pay him a large percentage of my salary cap.
Yeah.
And I'm committing that to a position that doesn't play 82 games and a position where, you know what? Shit happens. Goals go in. That goalie may still not be enough. There's a reason why a lot of the top goalies, you know, that we've seen in the league, at least in the salary cap era, don't end up on the Stanley Cup winning teams. Like Henrik Lundqvist never won a cup. He got close. He got to the finals once. But when you pay that much money, they don't get there. The Lightning were smart and got there before Vasilevsky's contract kicks in. And they've had to do some real fun hijinks this year by sitting out Kucherov the whole year with this hip injury to be able to continue doing this. But can the Lightning even sustain their team now that they're paying Vasilevsky $9 million a year? You know, we've seen Montreal struggle to field a team around Carey Price. That's the problem. Like, even if they are successful, now I throw a bunch of money into that position and it makes it that much harder to build my team around them. So it's sort of like you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. If they have great outcomes, that's great, but I have to pay them money. And if they have poor outcomes, well, then I sort of wasted that pick. So it's like the perfect world is they give me above league average goaltending while I continue to pay them below market value.
Have you deduced who our Mr. Goalie is?
I mean, Jonathan Bernier, and I think he played like one game for the LA Kings or something like that. I can't remember it.
It wasn't one, but it wasn't very many. But my
it's
my
like point, less it, than 30 or something like that.
No,
right?
it's like 61.
Okay. So if you spent your 11th overall 100%. Pick and got 61 games from a player, you should not be happy with that.
And my point being, you got one of the goalies that like you would say, man, this guy had a 12-year career with like a career save percentage above 910. It's like a 913 career save percentage. You got a guy with a 10-year career, 13-year career. Actually, two of those are really short. So, but yeah, 11-year career, still going with like a 913 save percentage. By most definitions, that's an NHL starter. That's close to as good as you can like really expect to do picking a goalie at that range. And the Red Wings are just paying him $3 million a year to do it out of free agency. No asset costs. And you use your 11th overall pick on it. Like, who's the sucker there?
Yeah, I mean, that's what exactly it. To me, and even with these better goalies, even with these guys like Askarov and Spencer Knight, like we're seeing Spencer Knight in the NHL already.
I think Spencer Knight's going to be a stud.
I think
he's
going to be a
stud. But if you don't get Spencer Knight, then you bombed. Or Vasilevsky, you know what I mean? Like, then you bombed.
But even in that sense, right? Look at Florida's position by taking Spencer Knight.
Right.
Are they going to be able to maximize the value from Spencer Knight? Because if you're Florida, the way you maximize that value is you get Bobrovsky the hell out of there and you use that $7 million on somebody else.
Yeah.
Because that way you're getting ELC goaltending with Spencer Knight. That's how you maximize the value of that goalie is you get them to the NHL quickly, win by building a really good team around them while they're giving you above league average goaltending on an ELC. That's the way to do it. And it makes sense if you know how to do that, but you also have to understand that your kind of benefit you're going to derive from that player is limited to sort of those first few years if they are that good, because you don't want to commit that much money to them beyond that point. So it's almost like you sort of want to maybe consider drafting an elite goalie like that if you're like one or two pieces away.
Yeah.
And you think you can actually take advantage of their ELC. Because if you can't, then it ends up a wasted pick like, you know, for the Kings, like Jonathan Bernier was.
Right. And we talk about, you know, you want to draft for upside, all this and that. What I don't think you want to do outside of the top five picks or so, and specifically with skaters, actually, but what you don't want to do is draft players at their absolute ceiling. In other words, in order to make that pick pay off, they have to hit their absolute ceiling, right? Like if you pick a goalie in the second round and you think his ceiling is a starter, I'm fine with it. I know you might still have some hesitance, but if you think he's an everyday starter, if you think he's a Jonathan Bernier, you pick him in the second round, that's fine because you got an NHL starter in the second round. But if in order to pay off the 11th overall pick, I need a goalie to be Spencer Knight, Andrei Vasilevskiy, Connor Hellebuck, you know, one of the elites of the elite in the NHL, I'm playing myself there because the odds are they're not hitting their absolute ceiling, right? So like, I just have a hard time drafting a player at their absolute ceiling. That's what you're talking about, like drafting, like, help me out here. Like Kent Johnson, number one overall. It's possible Kent Johnson is the best player in this draft class, but you need him to be to justify that at that point. Right. And like, whereas I think with Owen Power, like he doesn't have to hit his absolute ceiling to be one of the top two or three players in this draft class. He can hit like an 85th percentile outcome, I think.
Yeah. And that's exactly, and that's sort of where I'm at with all of this is like, you know, and plus you're going to get 82 games out of those guys. You're going to actually get, and you can more freely some predictability, commit money to them. Right.
What they're going to give you in a year. You're not going to have this mystifying. If they have 10 bad games, it doesn't ruin your season.
That's exactly it. So that's sort of where I'm at with it. And plus I think the other variable here is exactly what you said, Max. We continue to see good goalies pop up out of low rounds. Dustin Wolf looks like a heck of a goaltender for Calgary. 7th round pick just a couple years ago.
Right.
You know, we're talking about Carter Guylander for Detroit being a potentially good goalie, 6th round pick a couple years ago. So there are guys you can get in these later rounds that just give you 85% of what the guy going 10th overall would. So to me, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go that route.
Yep. All right. Garth, thoughts on trading for Nolan Patrick as a reclamation project? I kind of love this one.
Yeah. I mean, Nolan Patrick, it kind of fits the mold of the kind of deals that
brutal season Steve statistically. Made.
Yeah, I mean,
single digit points.
Really brutal season. It kind of falls in line with what happened with, you know, Robbie Fabry kind of dealing with, you know, Patrick dealing with the concussion issues. Fabry obviously dealing with multiple knee injuries and seeing if he can get them for cheap and kind of have them come over. I have no problem making a deal like that, particularly if you don't think he's going to cost you that much. He'd be a fun, you know, player to bring into the system and sort of tease out if he's able to offer you anything.
I'd be same with Barron Hayton. I'd put him in the same conversation too. If you can get Barrett Hayton at the low, that's a buy low. These are two guys that have been drafted in the last 5 years. They're in their very young 20s all day. That's the perfect reclamation project you're targeting. You want what happened with Puljujärvi, right? Like Puljujärvi this year, all of a sudden he looks like a dude that you won't mind drafting in the top 10 again.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what you want. Same thing that's happened with Robbie Fabry since coming over from St. Louis. You want that kind of reclamation. There's always a potential it goes the way of a Brendan Perlini, but you know, that's the risk you take here, and it should be a low-risk deal both ways.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. All right, next one. Okay, we're going to have to get through this one kind of quick. Marcus G, question about offer sheets. We always talk about them, and often they seem like a reasonable way to acquire surefire young talent, but then nothing happens. Do you think it's possible that most GMs don't do it just to maintain each other's respect? I have heard this one thrown around so much in the 3 years that I've been on the Red Wings beat, and it boggles my mind that that's what people think is the inhibitor here. I think this one's kind of simple to me. It's like there's just so many layers to doing it. Like it's really easy for us to talk about because in theory it's a great idea. It's like this like. It's kind of the forced trade option on like NHL 21 or something, right? It's like, oh, what are you going to do? You're out of cap space. You can't match. But in reality, GMs have more options. Number one, you have to get the player to sign it. So it requires going after a player who is like, you know, willing to do something kind of radical to get his money or to get away from his current situation. That's the first one. They have to sign it, right? A huge obstacle, way bigger than we ever give credit for when we talk about this stuff. Number two, the other team can match, and I know people will say they're capped out, but if you want to talk about offer sheeting Elias Pettersson, as we have, and I think it's a fine idea to take an attempt at, Vancouver still has a week, and what's Vancouver going to do sooner? Let Elias Pettersson walk or give up the first round pick or whatever it takes, whatever drastic option it takes to dump Louis Erickson's contract and then be able to match? Because at the end of the day, unless you're offering Elias Pettersson $15 million, which by the way, would put you in a brutal position on top of the four first round draft picks that you're giving up to acquire him, Vancouver can find a way to match. You can make their life miserable, but they'll do it. That's their guy. Like, that's their break. That's the once in a generation break that you get. Theirs was getting Elias Pettersson at fifth overall. They will do, you know, radical things to protect that, right? So at that point, knowing that, if you're a GM, do you really want to go through like the time waste knowing that, like, if I do this, I'm not saying you don't put the feelers out, but why does it not happen as much? Because at the end of the day, if the other team's going to match, you know, you're doing one of two things. You are making their job easier, you know, like they don't have to negotiate anymore because they have the signed contract in front of them. And it's a deal that you at least deem palatable enough to do yourself. You're going to make their job easier like that and just make it so all they have to do is rubber stamp. Oh, yes, I do match. Thank you very much. That's kind of ultimately what happened with Sebastian Aho a couple years ago, right? Like Carolina all of a sudden has Aho on like a pretty team-friendly deal, courtesy of Montreal. Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, I guess Bergeron threw the most cupcake offer sheet that he possibly could there. But no,
but it was the one that he could make work, you know?
Right. And so you're absolutely right. Like, it has to basically be a big enough offer sheet that you think a team wouldn't match. And that's very hard to really pull off. And then I think the only other thing I'll add to that is I just think a lot of teams still struggle to evaluate draft picks and sort of that's contextualize, like, how valuable is this particular draft pick? I think we see that happen all the time with some of these trades that are made. So I think that's really the only other piece to it. But I don't think it's really related to respect for another GM. I think that sort of gets overblown.
Like if I told you Elias Pettersson was a UFA tomorrow, what contract would you give him? Like, what do you think the contract he would, what would you give him? What do you think the contract he would get is?
Yeah, I mean, as a UFA, you're probably looking at about 7 years, $8.5 million, $9 million, somewhere in that range is what I think would you do as a UFA.
I think you could get to 10 as a UFA, double digits. Like, I think you could get in the Tavares range, all that stuff. Like that, because he's a young player, he doesn't have the resume as Tavares, but I think you could justify it. But I'm saying in order to do that deal, number one, Vancouver's matching that deal all day. You'd have to go higher than that, what he would get on the open market, and you'd have to give up your next four firsts. Like, it's crazy. It's not unjustifiable or indefensible, but it's a huge, huge, huge ordeal in order to make it so that Vancouver wouldn't match it or Team X wouldn't match it or whatever. You know what I mean? So to me, I've always thought the best offer sheet strategy is to go with the guys that teams aren't going to move heaven and earth to accommodate. I wanted last season, if the Red Wings were going to make one, I was advocating do it on Eric Chernak because they have so many problems. They'll move heaven and earth to save like Cirelli and Sergachev. They're not going to move heaven and earth, or at least I didn't think at the time, to save Chernak. But I really like Chernak. It's possible they would make that, bite the bullet and do the Tyler Johnson dance to save Chernak. I don't know, but I think that's where you target. You target the guys who are like third pair, third line guys who you think can be second pair, second line guys, and you get them for the cost of like a second round pick. That's how I would do it.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think at the end of the day, they're just not utilized enough. And I think GMs could attempt to do it more, either following the strategy, like you said, or really going big on it. And again, that comes down to better valuation of draft picks, I think.
All right, last one from Ethan B, because I know you got to run. What was your favorite moment from the season?
I'll take two favorites. I think the Jacob Vrana 4-goal night was a lot of fun. I think it was really great seeing him just looked almost amused by the fact that he was able to just keep scoring goals. And then kind of a throwback to the beginning of the season, I think Christian Juice scoring that all-important power play goal to end the Red Wings' 40 consecutive power plays without a goal and raising, you know, more than $15,000 for the Jamie Daniels Foundation. I think those are probably the two best moments for me from this season.
Yeah, I think that Jamie Daniels Foundation one certainly ranks really high up there. Morale, I don't think on Red Wings Twitter was ever higher than that week or that range in there. I'm trying to think what else. The Robbie Fabry hat trick was fun. The Sam Gagne hat trick, especially because of the way it happened, was pretty fun. I think we're just kind of saying the best individual performances right now, but that's not the worst thing in the world either. So Joe Valeno's debut and Joe Valeno's first goal stand out as pretty good moments too. Maybe we'll have to keep a running tab of these next year in order to have a better kind of pool to pull from. But anyway, that will do it for us. We'll be back at you later this week, hopefully with a end of season press conference to break down. And if not, we'll make another episode out of your mailbag questions. So thanks again for listening and take care.